The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Hey folks, Kaiser here. We've got a new initiative at SupChina that I want to tell you about because I suspect many of our listeners are just the sort of people we want to get involved. And it's a chance for you China nerds to parlay your arcane knowledge into a little income. We've launched a consulting and expertise marketplace called SupChina Direct. The goal is to connect the best China-focused talent with the companies and organizations who need support for their China-related projects and initiatives. Think of us as the Airbnb of highly qualified, deeply experienced China professionals. We've already built out a pretty decent network, a couple of hundred independent consultants and boutique consulting firms. We're really looking for people who know healthcare, consumer and retail, macroeconomics, and of course, technology. And if your business is looking for experts in those or pretty much any other fields, for anything from market entry to due diligence to digital marketing to supply chain sourcing, just get in touch. So whether you're a subject area specialist who wants to pitch new clients, or if you're looking for just the right specialist yourself, go to www.supchinadirect and sign up today. Now, on with the show. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is simply the best way to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds and hundreds of sources, plus links to the original pieces on our website. Sign up for SupChina Access, and you get all that and much more, with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the latest on the trade war to the ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, well over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, coming to you today from the Seneca South Studio in downtown Durham, North Carolina. Jeremy is away on holiday this week in New Zealand. Today on Seneca, we're talking about the conservative resistance to reform and opening, the diehard advocates of a communist orthodoxy they think has been betrayed by China's embrace of market liberalization in the late 1970s under Deng Xiaoping. The far left in China goes by many, many names. They've been labeled left deviationists back in the Deng days. Then neo-Maoists, which is a name many in the movement itself came to embrace, or even, as a provocative and fascinating new book's title calls them, the New Red Guards. By whatever name, they represent not just some fringe end of the Chinese political spectrum for all their seemingly extreme views, but a political and ideological force that has remained very much in dialogue with the party leadership in China throughout the 40 years since reform and opening began, and these still matter very much today. So today, I am delighted to be joined here in Durham by Jude Blanchette, who, as listeners to the show will remember from a number of appearances on Seneca, had been working on this book for, well, we had you on back in, what, it was like March 2016, right?
Yep.
Anyway, welcome to the show, Jude.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Anyway, I remember it takes me back, though. So that was like one of the last shows that we did in our dingy old studio before.
That's right, yeah.
Before joining SupChina and coming to the States. That was, gosh, we had you back on again to talk about Xi Jinping's long, hot summer. We had you on to talk about in December about the 40th anniversary of reform and opening. That was a live show we did in New York. That was a great one. You've been hard at work on this book, China's New Red Guards, The Return of Radicalism and the Rebirth of Mao Zedong, which is actually officially released, perhaps not coincidentally, on June 3rd, which is tomorrow, at the time of our recording here on Sunday morning. Since then, Jude, you left the conference board in Beijing. You now cover China for the Crumpton Group in D.C. So anyway, welcome back, man. Congrats on the book.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this was your first book, and having talked to lots of people who have written books the first time, I always feel like I'm asking them about their first experience of childbirth or pregnancy and childbirth. How was the whole experience for you, man?
Yeah, if anyone wants advice on how not to write a book, I feel I can offer more in that in that vein than I can on how to write a book. The experience was incredibly helpful and beneficial because it gives a structure that forced me to read intensely and deeply about a narrower set of topics.
Right.
So I started out the project not really knowing anything about this topic. And so in that sense, writing a book is a great way to learn about something. So I would do it in a heartbeat again on a different topic for that same reason. On the other hand, it's really hard to write a book, I've learned. It's really hard to write a chapter that is well-paced and moves along and is moves your argument along. So I have a lot of respect for people who can write good books. And I think just even getting to 65,000 words of partially persuasive text for me was a real lift and a struggle.
Yeah, man. I mean, I can't imagine. I've tried it before. My wife at one point just gave me a year and said, yeah, go for it. If you can produce four chapters and a proposal and get a deal, go for it. We'll just eat savings for a while. But didn't work out. I guess it takes a little more than prepping for a podcast. Huh?
Yeah, although I think the sort of piece of advice I would give myself or anyone who's thinking about doing it is, it's that old logic of complex big tasks are just a series of interlinked smaller tasks.
Right.
And so for years, the reason it was taking me so long is not because I was buried away in the study making a lot of progress on this massive tome. I mean, the book is only 160 pages before footnotes and or before endnotes. I just kept thinking, all right, because I had a day job this entire time.
Right,
so I
right.
kept thinking, all right, I'll wait for a vacation and then I'll do 500 hours in a row of the book. And I realized I was really only making progress on it when you'd spend every day 30 minutes and just do that with
knock out a couple of paragraphs.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that was where progress happens, not this, I'll spend my whole weekend working on it, because I don't have that attention span, and my weekends are for craft beer and video games. So.
Okay. That is good advice, man. I'm seriously, at some point I'm going to have to try my hand at it again, and I will again ask you for what not to do. I don't know how much you can say about how much it's morphed from the time you first pitched it to the book that I just finished. It seems to me that there's less emphasis than you originally had talked about, including about the first decade of reforms. Yeah. About, you know, I mean, I sort of expected, I mean, I just full disclosure, I read your book in draft, and I was a little surprised when we talked about that maybe your publishers had pushed you a little more toward talking about more recent instances of neo-Maoism rather than the first, the 80s and, you know, Deng Liqun and Chen Yun and the likes.
Yeah, it's the book that is now coming out is actually the book as it was first conceived of the publisher. But after I started working on it, I went off on my own tangent and started taking the book in a direction that was more about, I just became fascinated with the 1980s. And as I was doing research, I really got stuck in that period. And so wrote out a bunch of chapters on various debates and individuals and intellectual currents of the 1980s. And as I got closer to publication time, just realized that there was not total alignment between me and what the publisher was expecting. So kind of had to leave a lot of that on the leave that behind. So if anyone wants to read spare chapters about Wham's 1985 concert in Beijing and what the pushback from conservatives in the party was, I'd be happy to share it with them.
Well, I'm going to make sure to ask you about that. I mean, because actually, let's do that. Let's take a little time and talk about what you did end up leaving on the cutting room floor. But first of all, I mean, you ended up with this intro, which I hadn't read, which was just fantastically coincidental. I mean, you were probably kind of delighted by the events surrounding the death of a certain Diao Weiming is his name, right? Diao Weiming. Maybe that's too macabre of a description. You weren't delighted.
Intrigued.
Yeah, but yes. You must have recognized that it was kind of an authorial windfall, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy. So he's the editor of the most prominent neo-Maoist website, Utopia, and you can explain the circumstances of his death, but it was, you know, total deus ex machina for your book, right? I mean,
yeah.
The guy embodies all the major themes of your book about the fraught relationship between the radical left and the mainstream, if you will, you know, Chinese Communist Party, especially here now in the days of Xi Jinping. So maybe you can talk about Diao Weiming, the circumstances of his death in North Korea, and how he does sort of, he's a perfect vehicle to take us into this book.
Yeah, and it's a little clickbaity to open up the book this way, but for those of you who remember, in the spring of last year, there was this mysterious bus crash in North Korea. And I first heard about it, I think, through Bill Bishop tweeting out something, a rumor that Mao Zedong's grandson had died in North Korea in some a bus crash on a rainy night in a road outside of Pyongyang. And so immediately, that's for Chinese politics, that's fascinating stuff,
right?
Of why is he in North Korea? What was this bus crash? And for me, it became even more intriguing when I found out that this was actually a group of tourists from China who'd been organized by Utopia, this prominent neo-Maoist website. And they'd been there doing one of their normal trips to North Korea they do to go see the tomb of or the grave of Mao Zedong's son, Mao Anying, who died in the Korean War. And the leader of this group, Diao Weiming, the guy you mentioned, I started digging into and found that in many ways he was a parallel for the journey of most of the people I talked about in the book, which is individuals who, although at first came to see the promise of a newly opening China, soon began to reflect upon and get angered by the costs of that reform agenda. So he moved down to, born in Shanghai, moved down to Shenzhen, began working at a relative's company, and began to see the treatment of migrant laborers,
right,
in Shenzhen. Were kind of being chewed and spit out by the factory of the world, you know, these companies down there who were producing cheap goods for the rest of the world.
Right.
And so that was his real political awakening. And through there began to seek out individuals who were also sharing concerns about some of the costs of reform. And like many people I interviewed, as he began browsing the web, came across this website called Utopia, and began to see for the first time a community of individuals who shared those same sets of concerns. So he actually hooked up with Utopia, ended up joining the organization, and began working on North Korea. And so began taking individuals to travel to North Korea, and started a tourist agency called Spark Travel.
Spark is a reference to a single spark.
Spark can start a prairie fire. Not a Mao Zedong quote originally, but one that Mao made famous.
Right.
So he was the leader of this trip to North Korea. And not only is his story fascinating and the story of why the heck they were in North Korea, but also how the news of the bus crash was originally
suppressed. Yeah.
And that for me was just very fascinating because it and this is what hopefully some of the book teases out, is the relationship that the Communist Party has towards a group like Utopia specifically, but more generally, what is the relationship between the quote-unquote the left or the individuals who still cling to a socialist vision for the country and the Communist Party of China? And that is a fraught, complex relationship, and one that has been evolving, you know, for decades and continues to evolve now.
I'm curious, was Diao himself a Communist Party member?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Okay.
It was piecing together that initial introduction was actually quite difficult because...
Yeah, it's limited sources.
I knew the name because he was prominent on neo-Maoist websites, but I'd never met him and interacted with him.
Right.
So I kind of had to piece that together by talking to people who knew him and the paper trail that was left online.
Right.
Just a short aside on the issue of Communist Party membership. A lot of the people involved in neo-Maoism are not party members.
Right. That's what was my assumption.
And so you see, this is why it's a legitimate grassroots independent movement with a lot of people, so TGY, people outside of the system,
mm-hmm.
Who are throwing bombs from the sidelines, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I a month or so ago, I recommended a couple of books that I had just read about the rise of American far-right groups, you know, various racist groups, you know, militia movements, posse comitatus, and, you know, white identitarian types. You know, these have been the focus of a lot of attention, especially since Charlottesville. I see incredible parallels between these two phenomena. Actually, I'd probably judge the Chinese ultra left maybe less harshly than I would judge they don't have maybe the propensity to carry out horrific acts of violence, although they're also apologetic about horrific acts of violence in China's history. But I mean, they both suck, for the record. There's a lot of parallels, though. I mean, there's the same kind of fundamentalism, the same suspicion of elites. Their ideology is built on the sense of betrayal, not just of the purity of the original, you know, Marxist Leninism model, but also the betrayal of these people they purport to represent, right. the working class. Just like, right. You know, the American right is all about the coal miners, right. And whatnot. Yeah.
Yeah, they both there's a deep shared sense of populism,
yeah.
In both. And I should say that the original, for me, the original spark of this book, or one of the ways I framed it in my initial proposal to the publisher, was this was back in 2012 when I started working on this, where the Tea Party was much more prominent then.
Right.
But I saw direct parallels between the neo-Maoists who are on the left and Tea Partyists who are on the right. Started with a deification of a founding father, right? So in the case of a Tea Party rally, if you were to go to one in 2009 or 10, you'd see people dressed up in
Jefferson,
and they'd be holding the Gadsden flag. And so there was a direct linkage between the connection to the founding ideals, misinterpreted, malinterpreted, perverted, however you want to say it, but nonetheless a legitimate sense that we're the rightful heirs to the vision the founding fathers first promulgated, and neo-Maoists, who obviously the founding father is Mao Zedong. And they both guard the legacy of the founding fathers because they believe, and I think rightfully so, that the power of historical myths for the legitimacy of a country or a government. And so for the neo-Maoists, you can't cede an inch on Mao Zedong, because if you tarnish the founding father of China, well, what does that say about the nation and the ideals that the nation was built upon? And I think same with the right and their jealous guarding of the founding fathers and the legacy of the founding fathers. So just I remember in 2004 or so when the book came out on Sally Hemings, who was Jefferson's slave, they'd also fathered a child by. And I remember at the time, National Review and other right-leaning publications were outraged by the book and tried their best to poke holes in the scholarship of it. I think less because they had a legitimate beef with the historiography of the book, and more because they recognized, or they thought, there was a threat of dethroning Thomas Jefferson, because so much of the political program is built on at least some strong identification with Thomas Jefferson.
Exactly. I remember that Trump, during the controversy of removal of Confederate monuments in the South, just ahead of Charlottesville, he was saying, what next, Thomas
exactly.
Jefferson?
Yeah,
I
exactly.
mean, right.
And again, you could hear parallel quotes from, in the book, I've got a lot of parallel quotes from people on the left saying, look, once we dethrone Mao Zedong, what's next? What's, you know? We're going to go after, we're going to Sun Yat-sen. We're going to go after. So, same again. And I don't want to step in the middle of a partisan debate here. It's less that
too late.
Well, yeah. But I just think there are really interesting parallels between China's domestic political currents and how political movements work in China and how they work other places in the world.
Right. Funny, I just read Joseph Ellis's Founding Brothers, which is great, really terrific book. Ellis himself ended up coming around on this idea of Sally Hemings. He originally was very, very opposed to the idea, and then later on, with the genetic evidence, it's pretty indisputable that there were all these people who were, Anyway, wow, fascinating. So one of the similar features, of course, is they both use the internet extensively,
right.
and very well, I should say. For mobilization. Here in the United States, of course, there's this whole process. There's this sort of funnel where they get you. If you're, if you're somebody who maybe, has sympathies for the men's rights reaction to strident feminism, or if you're one of these people who feels victimized by affirmative action, left out of opportunity because you're a white male, they try to get you with some of this stuff. And then there's this kind of path they lead you down that eventually leads to this kind of red pill moment where they present you with this, that thing, that trope from The Matrix. Is there something like that? Do you see parallels like that for online radicalization in China?
But I would say less top down. And just again, because I don't want to continue stepping in a partisan debate, I think this is just a form of how a lot of online communities form, right? Whether this could be ISIS, this could be the Flat Earth Society. There's a lot of groups who you see a similar pattern by insofar as how people come into a group, how they first find a group. So these are marginalized, disaffected individuals who feel like the mainstream, however you define that, the mainstream or elite institutions are not listening to them. 4chan is another example.
Sure.
So you go out in search of individuals who share the same perspective, and you find you begin organically grouping around certain key nodes, you know, websites or publications or radio shows or, you know, Alex Jones's show. And communities are built that way, almost to quote from F.A. Hayek, the great libertarian economist, you know, a sort of spontaneous order by which these groups form. And neo-Maoists wouldn't have existed as a movement had it not been for the internet.
Right. Was there an internet moment that galvanized them? I mean, maybe like, was it the 99 embassy bombing or was anything like that that...
Yeah, that period between the embassy bombing, so this is the NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade in 1999, which was, despite good evidence that it was an accident, nonetheless, for Chinese nationalists and for a lot of normal Chinese people, this was a really galvanizing moment.
Sure. I have yet to.
Because it's hard to believe that such a catastrophic mistake could have been made. But starting in the late 90s, but I think that the specific moment with which the internet became fundamental for neo-Maoists was after the Three Represents, which was Jiang Zemin's
we'll get into that. After the Three, yeah, sure.
So after, I'll put it aside for what that was for a moment, but several key print publications were shut down by Jiang Zemin in 2002, 2003. And these are old established, thick theoretical journals, but nonetheless had been essentially the only remaining outlets for what we call, you know, conservative intellectuals, disaffected, who were unhappy with China's development trajectory. And after those publications were shut down, they really looked cast about to see what to do next. And I think had there been no internet, it would have been quite difficult for them to reconstitute a movement. But they saw this fledgling piece of information technology which was out there, and this is the early days of you know, BBS, of bulletin boards. So quite crude, but nonetheless, this provided a public square, so to speak, where individuals could come together.
No less crude than Reddit.
Totally.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the same kind of thing, right? It's pretty amazing. So I want to just turn now and start talking about what it is that we miss when we don't pay attention to these guys. I mean, you talk in your book about the tendency for us China watching types to devote a lot of attention to intellectuals in China who are sort of on our side, as it were, the liberal-minded, sort of reform-minded, or even dissident intellectuals who advocate for a kind of basket of values that we share, you know, for rule of law and for universal human rights and what have you. I would certainly agree with that. But I guess my usual thing is, hey, but look at the mainstream intellectual. And that's usually what my response to when I see so much attention devoted to people, you know, on the liberal fringe. I tend to say, hey, look, you know, let's try to understand the David Brooks. Who's the David Brooks of China, right? I mean, the sort of, you know, moderate conservative, like, you know,
he's a barometer of where the conventional wisdom is.
Exactly, right. So I'm always, but you're right though that we need also to pay attention to the people who are out there on the fringe. You know, we shouldn't be too dismissive of them because they really are in dialogue and they still are a relevant part of the conversation there. What are we missing, though, when we ignore the conservative reaction to reform?
Yeah, and I should just to step back a moment and say that I don't pretend like I've always been looking for these conservatives. I think for most of my formative time looking at the current of ideas that was impacting China, I too was looking at signs of hope and signs that individuals in China who shared a set of values as the rest of us were in the majority and were moving policy in a direction that we all agreed with. So I think it's quite natural that you look for confirmation bias. And so it really wasn't until China's politics began to shift in a different direction that I think there's China watchers began to try to find what's motivating this shift? What's influencing this shift? And that's when I began to look at the neo-Maoists, and that was really the first time. And through the process of understanding where the neo-Maoists came from, that's when I was really opened up to this whole other world of discourse that had always been there, and had undulated in strength throughout the past four decades, but had been the sort of the shadow of the reform movement and the shadow of the reformers.
Right.
And so whereas I thought it was a much more linear progression from, let's say, 1978, you know, the vaunted third plenum, where reform and opening, you know, nominally was first promulgated straight through, say, WTO. I thought that was a fairly linear journey, except for a deviation in 1989, June 4th. But what I realized is there'd always been this intellectual, ideological struggle that had been going on.
Right.
And on net, China did reform over those three decades. I think now we're in this moment of buyer's remorse, where we're sort of saying we got the whole thing wrong and you know, the whole bet on China was misplaced. But I think it's a little short-sighted to not recognize that China did go through some pretty significant political and economic transformations over the past three decades, and for the better. But nonetheless, it wasn't as seamless a victory as I initially thought. And by not understanding or the complexity of that debate, we really missed how imperiled oftentimes the reform agenda was.
Yeah.
And now, to me, looking at how neo-Maoists, for example, have moved from being outside dissidents who were calling for the overthrow of the Communist Party to essentially sort of quiescent brown shirts working for the party, that tells me a lot about where the
politics
where the politics of the party are.
Just in more recent years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, the last decade. So it's the imposition of our good old Whiggish teleology, right, on this whole process.
Yeah, this is not just a China thing, right? So
no.
We always do this.
We
invade a country, we look for the Ahmed Chalabi who we think shares our, you know, shares our values, yeah. And we think if we get them in place, everything will be all right. So I should have looked it up in advance, and maybe we can put a link in the recommendation section. But there was a piece someone did about Saudi Arabia, and about for the past three decades, we've always talked about finding a reformer.
Right, we thought it was MBS.
MBS, right? And so this is a structural element of American politics. We're always looking for the reformer, you know, white knight reformer.
Yeah, I mean, the perennial hope for China's Gorbachev, right?
Yeah.
We are always looking for that guy. We talk about the 80s a lot, and your book does, as this period where, at least within the sort of newly unencumbered intelligentsia, there was quite a bit of intellectual ferment going on, a lot of kind of grand ideas that gained currency momentarily. I want to talk about one of those ideas in particular. It's one that I looked at quite a bit while I was a graduate student in the early 1990s in connection with technocracy, because they really were sort of a piece. That whole sort of obsession with Singaporean style, neo-authoritarianism, Xin Quan Wei Zhuyi. And this figures in your book. And it strikes me that it's interesting because it seems to be sort of one of a common ancestor between both the kind of Dengist economic liberalization with political control on the one hand, and the neo-Maoists. They sort of find their origins in that period too, as you suggest. Can you talk a little bit about Xin Quan Wei Zhuyi?
Yeah, so out of this period of the 1980s, we began to see, as the public square opened up, which it did, it was a time of great intellectual, you know, ferment and enlivenment, and chaos, and all the you know, amazing things that were happening in the 1980s leading up through 1989. But out of that period, when you have a more open public square, you have a multiplicity and of ideas, and one of these was a reaction to incipient problems in the reform agenda that were already being noticed by the early 1980s, right? So people who were looking at issues of state capacity, i.e., how effective at governance is the government and the Communist Party, and seeing that liberalization had led to a deterioration of the government's ability to push and implement policy. You saw a rise in crime that was happening as the party was releasing its control over the economy. You saw corruption on the rise, economic crimes, as they call them. So you saw a host of problems that were emanating out of the reform agenda. And as individuals began to look at it, they began to see that we needed to find a better balance between what appeared to be this unplanned chaos that China was moving towards in reform and opening, and the older, much more centrally directed control. We need to find a balance. One of the individuals who was an early important progenitor of new authoritarianism was Wang Huning.
Wang Huning, of course, now sits on the Politburo Standing Committee, or stands on the Politburo Sitting Committee. He's the party ideologue, right?
Right.
You know, the only sort of academic who's on. Right.
And at the time, in the mid-1980s, he was this brilliant young political scientist at Fudan University who was fascinated by Singapore. And he actually led or was a coach on the Fudan University debate team when they made this trip out to Singapore. And he, you can find this article online on the website iSusyang. He wrote this very long love letter, essentially, to Singapore about his time there. And he was just fascinated by the wealth created by Singapore, but the order and control. And this seemed to indicate that there was a third way between the quote-unquote chaos of the market and the stifling control of central planning, that there was this new way to do it. So Wang Huning and a group of individuals in the late 1980s began putting flesh on this new authoritarianism. And as you say, it was even attractive to the reformers like Zhao Ziyang and Deng Xiaoping, who saw in it the wealth-generating possibilities of a more robust market, but one within the iron cage of party control.
Right, within the four walls of the four cardinal principles.
Right, exactly. And so after 1989, neo-authoritarianism loses a little bit of its cachet because of its identification with Zhao Ziyang, who was, of course, purged right after June 4th, when he was then serving as general secretary. But it's rebranded again. And so we see a variety of new isms that emerge out of 1989. New statism, which was closely identified with an intellectual named He Xin.
Uh-huh.
You see a lot of new isms coming out of this period, and a lot of them are reactions to 1989 and then, importantly, 1991 with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Let's talk about 89, since we're only 3 days away right now from the anniversary. The 30th anniversary. How does the radical left in China view the protests of 89 and their bloody, brutal denouement? Is there some interpretation that we don't see?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think you would think, given what we know about the current political program of neo-Maoism, that they would either, they would minimize or deny that there was any sort of massacre on June 4th. But in fact, that's not the case.
Right.
You find that a lot of them are really, there's actually a much more nuanced position on things like the Cultural Revolution and June 4th than you would originally think. Right.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
Recognizing that the party overreacted, that the party had stifled legitimate democratic voices who were calling for robust change. Part of it is just our own misunderstanding of the multiplicity of voices who were present at June 4th. So not everyone there was necessarily a liberal.
Right.
Right. And so there's a lot of neo-Maoists, older generation of neo-Maoists who were there. And who were present and who were very sympathetic and remain sympathetic to the students who were in Tiananmen Square for those couple months. So that's not a good predictor of where their politics are today.
No, I remember being in the square and seeing guys carrying Mao, posters actual portraits of Mao, carrying them. They'd been sort of nailed to stakes, and they were carrying them around. And I wasn't sure what was going on. I thought it was ironic.
Yeah.
I thought it was just sort of being done ironically, but no, it wasn't. That's fascinating. So 89, yeah, so no, you're right. And I think that's something that really bears a lot of examining. It's really fascinating what the reactions are, because, again, some of the other people who were, again, not neo-Maoists, but people, characters who went on to form the so-called New Left.
Exactly.
Yep. We're very much participating in this. I mean, in fact, the name most commonly associated, Wang Hui.
Yep.
Wang Hui was himself a participant in the demonstrations. He was, maybe a decade older, so he was in his 30s already when this was happening. He was actually investigated for this.
Yep.
He actually, did a year, in some, not in Laogai or anything like that. It was just sort of, he was being rehabilitated or whatever, not imprisoned or anything, but often, I think, Shaanxi province or something. But then went on to become a real advocate for state-owned enterprises, a real advocate for more state role in the economy, but also an advocate for the addressing of a lot of the inequalities that emerged from, really headlong, breakneck reform.
Yeah, just as you're saying that, just a really interesting and, to me, understudied historical moment is right after 1989, I think that first fall, for the next couple of years, every incoming, all incoming freshmen at Fudan University and Peking University had to go off for mandatory military training.
Right.
So I've interviewed a bunch of the neo-Maoists who were incoming freshmen into Beida, Peking University, right after June 1st, and they ended up spending a year in Shijiazhuang, the military academy, which is about an hour south. Hour and a half south of
West,
south
yeah,
Beijing.
Yeah, southwest of me. Rockville.
Right? And that really, yeah, exactly.
That's the funniest thing. I mean, they call Rockville, Maryland, Shijiazhuang, which is hysterical.
And that was really a formative period for a lot of these folks who had come in expecting to go into this elite educational institution. Instead, they're doing military drills at this base, and they have to do it for a year. And a few people who I interviewed who'd spent time there said this was really when they first began to have a negative opinion about the Communist Party because it had essentially taken their lifelong dream, and they'd been, you know, of going into, you know, China's most storied university. Instead, they're doing calisthenics in the morning and eating bad military food. So that's another interesting piece of this is the although we think of the neo-Maoists now as being guardians of the Communist Party, it's really had a very complex relationship with the CCP over the past couple decades, moving in from ally to opponent, and formative experiences. A lot of these people with the party helped shape how they looked at the Communist Party.
Let's get back to the New Left movement, which is something I'm pretty fascinated with because it's not easily characterized. It's not easily categorized. Where do you place it? Do they relate to the neo-Maoists, and how do they relate to the mainstream CCP?
Yeah, so just a potted history of the New Left is that it started in the early 1990s and primarily from a group of academics, young Chinese academics, who'd studied largely in the United States, so had been trained in methodology and discourse of social sciences here in the West. And so they bring these tools back and they begin analyzing China's reform agenda through the prism or the lens of quote unquote Western methodology.
Which is to say they learned a Western critique of capitalism.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, absolutely. Right. Exactly. And so the left in China in the 1990s and early 2000s was fairly ecumenical, and you had a lot of boundary blurring. It hadn't really hardened into these lines of, let's say, sort of neo-Maoists and New Left. It's also worth mentioning that the term New Left is, of course, contested by almost everyone we put in the New Left.
Right,
as most
like
of
it.
These labels are, they're usually pejoratives that are created by outsiders. So a lot of New Left don't see anything that is the New Left. But nonetheless, if you look at the late 90s, early 2000s, there's a lot of interaction amongst all these left intellectuals who later on would occupy opposing parts of the spectrum. But nonetheless, at the time, they shared a common concern about where China was headed, things like entrance into the WTO, things like SOE privatization, which took off in the mid-1990s and led to tens of millions of layoffs in really concentrated pockets in China's old industrial heartland.
And the third thing would be the three represents.
The three represents, right.
So let's do that. I mean, so Jiang Zemin and his premier, Zhurongji, they did a whole lot of things that pissed off people all across the left, right? The neo-Maoists, the New Left as well. There's this, like you said, a push to reform state-owned enterprises and to privatize a lot of state assets. And we can talk about this, you know, Larry Long controversy with regard to that. There was, as you say, China's push to join the WTO, which, you know, I think the New Left saw as like a way to shackle China to, you know, to the under the yoke of global capitalism. And then there was the three represents. So let's do these in order, these three things. Let's start by talking about SOE reform and the Larry Long affair.
Yeah, so I think most of us know the story of SOEs as being these large, bloated organizations, which I think a more neoliberal critique would say that these are nothing but a big productivity drag on China's economy. Chinese officials believed that as well in the mid-1990s, and under the then-premier Zhu Rongji set out a very aggressive attempt to shrink the size of the state-owned economy, in part to free up labor to move to other more productive areas of China. So migrants were now freed up to head down to the south and begin taking up positions at private factories, for example. But what this did is this led to estimated sort of 40 million layoffs where you suddenly had all these workers who had believed they were part of this social contract wherein they would spend their lives working at a SOE and be within that Danwei, that unit, and that's where they got their health care, their education. Suddenly,
Xiaogang was the zeitgeist word of the moment, right?
Yep, to lose your job. So suddenly had the Communist Party declaring that actually, no, that isn't the contract and we're going to tear that up and you're out on your own and you don't really have many skills to be able to compete in this new economy. So this was, in the 1990s, a really important catalyst for this embryonic leftist movement, which is beginning to take some sort of organizational form. And at that point, it was just really surrounding a couple key publications. One is called Zhongliu, or Midstream, and the other is Zhenli de Zhuichou, which is The Pursuit of Truth. And these were really minority-read publications. I mean, these were real, real dusty tomes. But nonetheless, they were very influential within the sort of tijerne, within the system, right? So a lot of older cadres, a lot of retired cadres would be writing in these publications, and these would be circulated around elite groups in policymaking circles. Second thing is entrance into the WTO, which was framed for the left as a selling out to capitalists, but crucially, and I think importantly, for those who were looking to oppose China's entrance into the WTO, they framed it as an old anti-imperialist narrative, which is global capital coming into China is a return to the exploitation of foreign powers in the 19th century, right? So they connected it with this older organic concern that the Chinese people had, which had been around for more than 100 years. So in addition to having the economic argument against the WTO, i.e. people saying, look, this is going to decimate our own domestic industries and our emergent private companies aren't ready to compete with global companies yet. So you had that narrow economic argument. You also had this political argument, which is this is another betrayal of the Chinese people by the Chinese government to allow foreign imperialists to come in and consume Chinese resources to their benefit. So,
well, in hindsight, I think I would have been persuaded by that argument. I can't say that China wasn't shackled to global capitalism in some pretty obviously negative ways as well, but. I wanted you to talk a little bit about Larry Long in that case, about SOE reforms.
Right.
Maybe just go back and fill that in real quick.
Yeah, so to try to tell this story in a little bit more of an interesting way, and again, I just always tried to find individuals to tell these stories. There's a really fascinating character who I knew of when I was living in China, but didn't know his backstory. Anytime you'd go to a Xinhua bookstore, you'd see this guy, Long Xianping,
right.
Larry
yeah,
Long. You know, for anyone who's lived in China, you'd recognize him right
exactly,
away.
Yeah.
Salt and pepper hair, glasses, and
he's Taiwan-born, right?
Taiwan-born, right. And did his PhD in University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
Couldn't get a job here in the United States. Later said he could have if he wanted to, but then moved to Hong Kong and then finally moved up to mainland in the late 1990s, early 2000s, I forget which, and made a name for himself of writing these biting exposés of Chinese companies and became quite controversial
right.
for what many people thought was him writing takedowns of companies because he was being paid by competitors. And in 2004, he gives this speech at Fudan University where he accuses a prominent Chinese entrepreneur of essentially corruption through a legal mechanism called a management buyout, an MBO.
Right, right.
And an MBO, just the very, very short version is, it's de facto privatization, but without having to call it privatization. You basically, the existing management of a state-owned company will get bargain basement prices to take over, to take the company private.
And he saw echoes of what had happened in the Soviet Union.
In Russia in the 1990s,
right.
Yep, the sort of oligarch cowboy capitalism. So he made this very prominent speech, which got a lot of media coverage, including, and this is to show you how different the times are, including in People's Daily and in a lot of party-owned media platforms. This became a real cause célèbre. And shows again how different the public square is nowadays, where we just can't imagine having this robust debate on the nature of state-owned enterprise and public and private ownership. Crucially for the story of neo-Maoism, the neo-Maoists recognized that they could use this narrower issue on MBOs or management buyouts to drive a much larger discussion, which is, what is the nature of our economy? what does it mean to have state ownership? What is socialist about our economy? And so in a pattern that we saw repeated again and again over the next 10 years or so, they would take a narrow issue or incident and tie it directly to a much more meta narrative about the socialist direction of the country. And so in the next year or so, as this debate is ongoing over management buyouts that Larry Long is doing his best to whip up, Utopia is sort of in the wake of that, helping to propel it forward and helping to keep the issue alive. And it became such a public issue that the party ended up essentially banning MBOs.
Yeah, shutting down MBOs.
And we don't know. We have no direct evidence that it was – there's no document tying this to the Larry Long issue. But the best I can make of the events surrounding it is that the public pressure and public outrage was such that the party responded with pulling back on MBOs.
Okay, because that of course happened during a different time. That was already in the Who and When era,
golden age.
Right. There's perhaps reasons why that happened. Let's talk about the three represents. I mean, this was seen as an existential threat to what the party was and what it stood for. I mean, this is something that's dismissed all the time by China watchers, or, you know, by the maybe not so sophisticated ones. It's just a piece of, you know, nonsense it does sound kind of preposterous, right? The party represents the most advanced forces of production. The party represents the most advanced cultural forces. The party represents the broad interests of the Chinese masses. Well, it sounds like, okay, so what is it? But what it really means was we're opening the party to participation by capitalists.
Or maybe I frame it, the party needs to evolve.
That's right.
The organization needs to evolve to keep up with the times. And so this is a piece, I think, of the post-89, post-91 restructuring of the party to make sure never again. So the belief that, you know, after 89, the party began to move more towards bringing students, and especially elite students, into the party. After spending much of the 80s ignoring students, they realized the threat there from having too much distance between students and the party. And likewise, in the 1990s, especially after 1992, when Deng Xiaoping sort of revived and restarted the reform agenda.
With his southern tour.
Which
we didn't talk about. Maybe we can make sure to insert something about, because, you know, I think you think we get the narrative a little wrong on that as well, right?
And I should point out, by the way, I very nearly get the narrative wrong in the book until the great Barry Naughton sent some comments on my chapter
okay,
saying
great.
Not quite the way this took place. But yeah, I'll come back to the southern tour, but just on the three represent story. After the private sector really starts to take off, or I guess I should say China's state capitalist model really begins to take off in the 1990s, of which private companies are an important part of that, the party recognized that what this meant is as the economy became more private, more complex, the party just had less insight into what the heck was going on.
Right.
And so one of the things to do to make sure that there isn't this huge gap and widening gap between the party and where the economy and society is going is you integrate with, you interlink with, or more cynically, you could say you co-opt. And so Jiang Zemin announced this in a speech in 2001 and formally enshrined in the party constitution later on. But this idea that essentially
three,
capitalists
right, yeah.
are welcome into the party now.
Right.
And what's interesting is, and this is why making sure our own external observer lens is always being calibrated. At the time, everyone saw this as a capitulation, right? And so this absolutely fit our narrative of, look, they joined the WTO. Now they're allowing capitalists in. We've got information technology, i.e. the internet is making its way there. It's a matter of time before this comes crumbling down or the party evolves into something more liberal. But crucially, before we get too self-critical, a lot of the leftists saw the exact same thing. This was evidence that the party had tuck-tailed and was submitting to global capitalists, and there's nothing communist about the Communist Party anymore.
Right.
Now, we know it's actually much more complex what was going on behind the scenes, but nonetheless, what they were doing is making sure that the party was integrated with this, you know, expanding private economy. And so looking back now from the perspective of 2019, the integration with the private sector really redounded to the party's favor, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. It really saved the party.
Yeah, absolutely.
Better or for worse.
To the issue of the Southern Tour, which to me, again, I learned so much in working on this book. The Southern Tour was just one of these dates I knew was sort of a hinge moment date, but I thought it was just about essentially revive, you know, 1989 conservatives take over for a couple of years, 1992 Dunn goes south and
conventionalism on that,
and that's not entirely wrong as a narrative, but I think we have to frame it in as a part of this much larger context of Deng's getting very old. He at this point had given over all of his formal titles, right? So he held on to being
chairman of the Bridge Association. Yeah.
Right, but yeah, that's another thing. By the way, you often hear people say, you know, when Deng had real power, he was only the chairman of the Bridge Association. Yeah, and he was the head of the military until 1989.
Right.
So he had the guns on his side, and he was smart enough not to get rid of all his titles. But after 1989. He still was by far the most important political figure in the country, and gave up his final title because he knew he didn't need it anymore.
Right.
There was no one who could hold a candle to Deng in terms of revolutionary credibility and political credibility.
But still, by 1992, he felt like he had to make this sort of flank maneuver.
Right. So, you know, Deng Xiaoping in 1992 recognizes his health is failing, and what he's concerned about really is the post-Deng era, right? He doesn't know how much longer he's going to live, and he knows that he had been there for much of the 1980s calling the ultimate shots. Deng was always relatively removed from actual policy, and he would only step in when the two sides, we could call them, you know, loosely conservatives and reformers, when there was a dispute that was
at an impasse, yeah.
At an impasse, or it was threatening to, or one side had gone too far in the reforming era, or one side had gone too far in a conservative tightening, Deng would finally step in. But he was happy to sit back and just as long as the ship was moving in generally the right direction. Problem is, Deng knows he's not going to be there forever. Right. So what he wants to do is essentially break the wheel.
Right.
To quote Game of Thrones, he wants to break the wheel finally and make sure that this reform agenda within the four cardinals. Guardrails is going to be the new normal, or as he said, no more debate.
Right.
We're done debating. We've had 10 years to debate. We've seen what happens when the party is at each other's throat. So now we've decided it's my way, and so he gets on a train in Beijing and he heads south, heads all the way down to Guangdong Province, goes to Shenzhen, goes to Guangzhou.
We'll stop in Wuhan while he delivers the first important speech.
Stopped in Shanghai, yeah. But essentially, you know, our takeaway from that is he was there to wag his finger and say, this is it. This is the way we're going to do things from here on out. And this was a tactic Mao would often use when you feel like you're not getting the consensus you need in Beijing. You leave the capital and sort of go out directly to the people, go out to officials around the country and build an external consensus. And that essentially did create a new paradigm. I should say it's a little bit more complex than this. There was also maneuverings of personnel at the 14th Party Congress later in 1992. And that's really where we see Jiang Zemin come into his own. We also see the next generation of leaders put into position, so Hu Jintao. So Deng not only created the theoretical line, which was going to guide party policy, but also made sure there was personnel in who were going to follow his orders.
Well, let's get back up to back into the 2000s. A period that I'm fascinated with, of course, this golden age that we talk about. Li Cheng from Brookings used to talk about these two sort of dominant factions. And the Hu and Wen years represent a period where the so-called Tuan Pai were sort of in the ascent, right? Were you have actual interest in addressing some of the excesses,
right,
of income inequality, of geographic inequalities, of starting to be quite concerned about the plight of agrarian toil in China, of environmental degradation. This must have sounded good to the ears of your neo-Maoists, and yet they seem to still have been sort of in active opposition at that time.
Yeah, that's clearly there was a shift in policy in 2003, 2004, but not long after Hu Jintao comes into power, along with Wen Jiabao, who is the premier then. But a real marked shift from the Jiang Zemin era, and one that Barry Naughton in a great essay calls a sort of a pronounced left tilt in policy. So you saw much more prominence of rural agricultural issues come to the fore of government policy. You saw this talk of harmony, of harmonious development. So we're going to move away from, at least nominally, we're going to move away from the cutthroat, some have to get rich first. you know, that epitomized the Jiang Zemin era of real elite technocratic pro-capitalist policy.
Right.
We're going to rebalance back now towards, we're still going to have open markets, we're still going to be integrating with the global economy, but we're going to put more precedence on solving domestic issues. And I think arguably the spread of information technology and the awareness now that Chinese people had of issues in other parts of the country was playing a role in that. And Utopia, the neo-Maoists, were also an important node of spreading stories about the maltreatment or mistreatment of migrant laborers. Some of the more horrendous cases of slavery and brick kilns.
Right.
All these things now, which could have been contained by local party cadres, are now, again, not imperfectly, but are now beginning to spread more, and there's more awareness and there's more pushback. So this kind of honeymoon between neo-Maoists and the Hu Jintao era lasts about a year or two.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think began to happen is that the neo-Maoists became much more dogmatic in their ideology. They began to see, or they began to believe, that within this left tilt, the Communist Party was also engaging with and bringing into elite circles individuals who, in the next couple of years, the neo-Maoists would come to openly call traitors, right? Traitors with a T, not traitors.
Right.
Not people who trade.
Right.
So these are intellectuals like He Weifang,
yeah,
Zhang Weiying, Mao Yushi, people who...
Jin Yumi.
Exactly. People who we would call liberals,
right,
are now moving their way into the system. And so beginning around 2007, 2008, you see a pronounced shift in the neo-Maoist movement from kind of a pan-leftist movement to much more dogmatic, much more conspiratorial, and much more wedded to the historiography and the history of the Mao era.
There's also a sort of a foreign component to this when they suddenly start with China's in the spotlight and they run up to the Olympics, and suddenly the whole discourse on Tibet and a whole bunch of
other things. 2008 was just absolutely crucial year, not only for the global financial crisis,
which discredits American-led capitalism as well.
Exactly.
Right,
right, right. Yep. But also because you had a series of domestic and international events that involved China. So you had the riots in Tibet. You had that incident where the woman carrying the... So we obviously had the Olympics later in August that year, but in the spring there was a Chinese woman who was carrying the torch in France.
Right.
And the torch was knocked out of her hands.
Leads to the Carrefour boycott.
Yeah, the Carrefour ban. So you had a pretty extraordinary year in China in 2008. And I think now, by the way, after Xi Jinping came to power, a lot of us were marking sort of 2012 as the pivot year, right?
No.
And now I think we're realizing we're really pulling back the timeline then. And
I've been on that for a while.
You've been on that for a while, right. Absolutely. But I think there's a consensus now that something in the water in 2008, 2009 in terms of domestic political currents, but also international events, really nudge China's development trajectory in a different direction. And that's where you see the sort of hard line, if we use the Feng Shou dichotomy, that's really where the show, the constriction period began.
But even as that's happening toward the end of that decade, they find a new champion in the Southwest, in Chongqing, right? And so they start gravitating toward Bo Xilai. I think any listener to the show is pretty familiar with Bo Xilai and all the events surrounding his downfall. But let's take it back a couple of years and talk about Bo in Chongqing, about the Chongqing model, about, you know, sing red, strike black, and all that stuff. And what was appealing about that to the neo-Maoists?
Yeah, so we had this very unlikely hero for the neo-Maoists, this besuited, very slick cadre.
Well, he's, you know, Trump for the
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, his son was attending elite schools in the UK. He had worked for the Ministry of Commerce and had made a name for himself in attracting foreign capital to the city of Dalian, where he was the party secretary. And his father was party royalty. So really, interesting character. His wife was a very high-flying, prominent lawyer who'd written a book, How to Win a Lawsuit in America. Bo Xilai is installed as party secretary in Chongqing. And again, you can't imagine this happening today, but there was a period after he's installed in Chongqing where he's in sort of essentially open declaration that he has higher aspirations politically. But crucially, he's in a open policy debate with the party secretary of Guangdong province, Wang Yang, right?
The Chongqing model versus the Guangdong model.
Right? Yes, right? Or they called it the cake debate.
Right.
Right? Do you
grow the cake?
Do you grow the cake, which is the sort of more market-friendly Wangyang idea, the rising tides lift all boats, or do you better redistribute the cake, which is the Chongqing model? The Chongqing model, which was really, I think, solidified around 2009, was essentially an attempt to address some of these existing issues with China's development and some of the costs of development, right? So this is making it easier for migrants to stay in Chongqing and not face as many hukou pressures. This is about building more affordable housing, better access to healthcare. So it was really a package of ideas that was spoke absolutely to the center of what the neo-Maoists had been complaining about. So you had this flock of intellectuals out to Chongqing. And I should add, so New Left intellectuals who are going out there. Henry Kissinger went out there and kissed the ring. Bo Xilai was an absolute celebrity and a star in not only China, but internationally in this sort of 2009, 2010 period. Articles in the New York Times about, a party secretary doing new things for a new China. You know, and he's in Chongqing, this just massively impressive city, which anyone who's not been there, it's just an absolutely fantastic place and visually such a striking,
it really is.
Striking city.
It's intimidating to me. You've got
cranes everywhere when Bo Xilai's out there, right? And so this is ostensibly people-powered development that he's driving there. And then just if you want to just put icing on the cake for the neo-Maoists, he then does this kind of red revival where he says, look, we've got this great treasure trove of
revolutionary songs,
yeah. and that we got to dust this off. We got to celebrate this. So he institutes this campaign of this Sing Red Songs campaign and this Red Culture campaign, where he's no longer ashamed of the Communist Party's revolutionary history. He wants to bring it out and celebrate it. Now, again, this is a manicured. He's not sort of saying Zhao Fan You Li. He's not saying to revolt is right. He's not sort of bringing out the unbridled Maoism of take down the party apparatus and the capitalists within the party.
It's just this the songs and the spirit.
Yeah, exactly. Right? This is a real 1950s sort of safe revolutionary discourse about how great the Communist Party is. But nonetheless, for the neo-Maoists, this is the best shot they've got, and they went all in on it. And so they're sending tour groups out there on their website. They're writing article after article about Bo Xilai for general secretary. I mean, this is sort of open election season.
I mean, that proved to be his and their undoing, though. Right. I mean, in a lot of ways.
Right.
Yeah.
So the proximate cause is, I won't rehash this.
Yeah,
well,
Wang Lijun's flight.
Yeah, the proximate cause is the murder of a British citizen, Neil Haywood, in a hotel by Bo Xilai's wife, Wang Lijun, who is Bo Xilai's right hand man and the
chief of police and vice mayor,
colorful character, fled to the consulate nearby Chengdu, and consulate kicks him out. He's thrown to the wolves, and this leads to Bo Xilai's undoing. And suddenly, the party is shocked that there is all this corruption going on in Chongqing. How could we have known? And on March 14th, 2012, during the NPC, the Lianghui, the two meetings. Wen Jiabao gives this amazing press conference where he warns of the sort of haunting specter of the Cultural Revolution that still hangs a casa pall over the country. You know, the Cultural Revolution has evolved to become this boogeyman. You know, that if you ever think the country's going too left, a leader can come out and say, never forget the legacy of the Cultural Revolution.
Right, which is why, the title of your book is so striking that you called them this new Red Guards. Oh, by the way, wasn't the title supposed to be Under the Red Flag?
That was the second iteration of title. The title that ended up being on the book is the title that was on the proposal when I submitted it to the publisher.
Okay.
It's breathless and clickbaity, I'll admit, because... it's one of these titles I have to spend time clarifying what it's not, rather than what it is. And it is not saying that this is why the word new is important in the title. I'm not saying that these are the old Red Guards and that we are going to expect neo-Maoists sort of parading through the streets calling for the overthrow of the Communist Party. But nonetheless, I do think there's a reason Wen Jiabao chose to invoke the spirit of the Cultural Revolution when essentially he wanted to warn about the neo-Maoists and Bo Xilai. that there is this thread of radical politics, which is always a threat to the Communist Party, and the most powerful fuel for this radical style of politics is not the sort of Liu Xiaobo, Ai Weiwei, you know, constitutional democracy. That's not what the party's really afraid of. It's more concerned about people who outflank it from the left.
And that brings us to today, right? You know, to what's happening right now, or that's happened in the last 6 months, really, just as you were putting the manuscript to bed, in Beijing itself, with from China's most prominent universities, these Marxist study groups who have gotten involved in labor activism and have been detained and disappeared. Yeah. And tell us what's going on there and how you read this into the whole relationship between the neo-Maoists and the CCP.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating, tragic, but fascinating development that almost feels like this could have been from 100 years ago when the Communist Party was, you know, when Mao Zedong was first acting as a labor and you know, a worker advocate down in Hunan province. You've got this group of students at China's most elite universities who have found common cause with disaffected workers from this one company called JASIC, J-A-S-I-C, who had been, starting last summer, who had been really poorly treated and had decided that they wanted to form a union. And the party just came crashing down on these workers and then the students who were advocating on their behalf with a intensity and a violence that I really caught people off guard.
But
what made it so striking was these are students who were framing their work on behalf of the workers squarely within the sort of Mao Zedong Communist Party. We take what you have said seriously. Everything had been framed in a way that made it very difficult, or at least it was jarring to see the Communist Party of China crack down on students who were acting on behalf of Marx and communism to help the most disadvantaged within China. That was so striking about it.
Yeah, jarring for some people. I mean, James Palmer is the Asia editor for Foreign Policy. He and I don't agree on everything, but one thing that he said I thought was just amazing, which was just perfectly honest, is communists going after other communists for not being the right kind of communist.
The most communist thing ever?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure.
He's absolutely right.
Sure. But this was not some internecine feud between, you know, Stalin and Trotsky.
Right.
This is a I think we've all become very cynical about the Communist Party. So I don't want to sound too breathless here. Like, it's not that much of a surprise because clearly what they're worried about is a single spark can start a prairie fire. And the Communist Party started out as 12 people in a room in Shanghai, and now it's 89 million people.
Right.
They understand the danger of embryonic movements. That's clearly what they're concerned about.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean,
and they've done this. This is not new. They've done this to lawyers.
That's right.
You know, so I don't want to pretend like this is new, but this is striking because this, I think, finally removes, if you had any remaining leg on your stool of the Communist Party having any sympathy for the plight of workers and of real, actual Marxism and a socialist vision for the country. This I think cuts that off because they're more concerned about political stability and remaining in power, and they'll crush anything, even if it is a organic movement of students to fight on behalf of China's workers.
So are you making an argument that China is not in fact ideological?
Oh, interesting setup question. No, and we've talked about this before, and there's obviously the word ideology, like the word legitimacy, is fraught with misunderstandings and vagaries, and I think we all use ideology in vastly different ways.
Right.
But
according to
our ideology, you know, ideology is usually something we say that the bad guys are doing, right? So, you know, Marxist-Leninist organizations are ideological, you know, whereas we're pragmatic. But there's this idea, and I think John Garneau gave a speech which Bill Bishop excerpted, and it's a compelling speech. But he makes a core argument that we've really seen a quote, you know, a return of ideology under Xi Jinping, or a resurgence of ideology. And my perspective is looking back at the debates that have been there all throughout the reform and opening period, but especially looking at a man like Deng Xiaoping, this was a deeply ideological person. You know, the four cardinal principles which he outlined in the spring of 1979, which basically said,
uphold.
We're going to reform an opening, but here are the guardrails, right? We will never challenge the party. We will never challenge, you know, we will never have a different ism other than Marxism, Leninism. You know, this is going to be a very restricted type of reform and opening.
Right.
And then after the 1992 Southern Tour, where a more clear picture of China's state capitalism emerges and this declaration of no more debates, what he meant is my ism will be the only ism.
Right.
That's a pretty strict ideology.
I mean, you could say his was sort of is pragmatism an ideology? I don't know. Is agnosticism a religion? I don't know.
You know, Chung Lee has a new essay out where and I apologize, I forget the name of the co-author, but he basically says Xi Jinping is firm about the goals, but flexible about the tactics taken. Right. So even within this highly ideological, you know, Xi Jinping era, we're seeing people saying the goals are inflexible, but the tactics aren't. And I think that's a really great way of describing Deng Xiaoping. Ideology has always mattered in China. It will continue to matter. This is how the party communicates future directions in policy, is through these code ideological words that to us seem like, you know, dreary renderings of sort of Marxist nonsense, but the party still speaks. And you know, you see on the People's Daily, you'll see headlines with the word dialectical materialism
you can still learn a lot by listening to what they
even
say.
If we're, and I think we talked about this, we can say that the party's ideology is muddled, right? We can say that, but it doesn't mean there was no ideology 10 sure. years ago. And again, the neo-Maoists would not have come to existence if they didn't think the party had the wrong ideology. They thought the ideology was neoliberal and they needed to combat that.
So you basically argue that there's always been ideology and there's always been politics. I mean, at the core of your book is this assertion that, yeah, even in China, in this authoritarian state, where a lot of people claim that people bargained away,
right.
they've sort of waived their rights to political participation in any form or to, you know, giving
there's an unspoken social contract.
Right. I mean, you know, that's a pretty common trope, and it's one I've probably used in some form or another. But you know, I've deployed that. They actually do, you say, have the politics that it's still quite, you know, contested. It does impose some limits on even a leader as powerful, somebody who's arrogated so much authority to himself like Xi Jinping, that there are fetters on what he can do. Can you expand on that a little bit?
We were just talking about the Marxist students, and I think that's a good example of here's a group of the best and brightest in China who apparently haven't signed on to this unspoken contract, right?
Right.
So clearly there are limitations to how much politics can exist on China. And those limitations are the amount of violence and coercion that the party uses to make sure that the public square is only talking about the things the party wants it to talk about. So we've just seen an absolute devastation of the public square, which was always limited. But we were just talking about the golden era in Hu Jintao, thinking, I mean, that was the halcyon days. If you think
absolutely.
Back now about how much discourse was permitted. But over the past couple of years, we've seen magazines like Yanhuang Chuncho be shuttered. We've seen Unirule, which is Mao Yushe's think tank, literally be welded shut. We've seen the crackdown on rights slurs. You know, we've seen Weibo absolutely eviscerated in terms of being an interesting platform. So we've seen, you know, WeChat now has much more restrictions on what can be said. And if you start a group, you're legally, you know, responsible for
That's
what people
right.
say. In other words, don't start a group. So there's definitely limitations on politics, but that's not to say that Chinese people don't have agency and aren't deeply, deeply interested and invested in the future direction of the country. Looking at the sort of quiescence, which is being enforced through coercion, shouldn't be mistaken for disinterest, or that the fact that people are just focusing on putting bread on the table and don't care about
it's infantilizing.
And it's, you know, we have a lot of tropes, and I'm all for tropes because tropes are helpful for you know, we all need heuristics.
Yeah,
the world is infinitely complex. We just got to make sure our heuristics are right. And I remember,
and they're flexible.
Remember
they
the one about growth? If economic growth falls below 8%,
right.
That's going to spell catastrophe for the party. You know, and I don't remember anyone who had been saying that admitting after it dropped to 7.5,
and now to 6.
I think we need to constantly be interrogating. Constantly interrogating our heuristics. And the reason I think the sort of China has politics too trope, which is I use it so much it's becoming a trope, is important, is as we're, for example, going into this really dark period of U.S.-China relations, as analysts, one of the things we want to understand are, what is the sort of incentive structure for Chinese leaders to make decisions? What are the constraints on how they make decisions? And if we have a heuristic of there's a totally empty public square and it's just Xi Jinping who's sitting at a desk making decisions, that's going to give us a really warped perspective on what his option set is, rather than probably the reality, which is Xi Jinping's probably the most lonely person in China who's not getting great information because he probably has subordinates who are misinterpreting and malreporting information to him. Unlike a leader in a constitutional democracy who feels legitimate after an election, Xi Jinping is in many ways probably feeling like he has to run for office every day because he doesn't have that legitimating moment like an election, right? So he probably feels more imperiled than most democratic leaders. And so they absolutely care about what the quote-unquote people think, even if it's in different ways that we care about how the people think in a constitutional democracy, right? So understanding that China has politics too, however we want to interpret it and analyze that, I just think is an important starting point.
There's a conversation I had recently. I can't say who it was with, but with a couple of prominent intellectuals in China where we talked about this. We talked about the party's use of technology right now, specifically of big data and AI, and the app, the Xueqi Qianguo app. They made the case, they were both very, very emphatic about this, that we're seeing something that we have not seen before. We've seen this, a mechanism through online sentiment analysis that could yield real responsiveness in some sense. They're looking very, very carefully at subtle shifts in public opinion and quite granularly, just local expressions of public dissatisfaction with particular policies and things like that. And so in some ways, the very top of the party leadership is more responsive than it's been ever, but it is disintermediating the entire middle bureaucracy in doing this. It's making it really, really difficult. At the same time that this is happening, which is, you know, you might see as a positive, definitely a mixed, but at the same time, the party now has this downward transmission mechanism from the very top through this app to the whole of society, again, disintermediating the entire middle layers of bureaucracy. This is something that we should be sort of looking at and trying to understand. What happens like that when you have, you know, it's a bit like Trump and Twitter.
I was going to say, that seems like Trump and Twitter. That's really interesting, right? And I hadn't thought of this before. It's a really interesting thesis, and I don't know what the implications are. But as you were saying it, I was thinking, yeah, it's exactly like Trump and Twitter.
The second part of it, the first part of
exactly like is not the right way. It has parallels to how Trump communicates with people in the United States through a direct medium. It's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. But that disintermediation and what the impact on the bureaucracy and what the impact on policy implementation would be, but also the impact of sort of job satisfaction for cadres who are now. Right. Feel probably cut out, even more marginalized.
On the way up and on the way
down.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
It's really interesting. Yeah. Anyway, man, what a fun time it is to have you. I mean, I always just enjoy having you on the show and want to, you know, get you on more regularly in the future. Let's move on to recommendations. I mean, thanks for just a terrific conversation. Let me, again, congratulate you on the book. To remind listeners, it's called China's New Red Guards, The Return of Radicalism and the Rebirth of Mao Zedong. It's out right now. Recommendations. But first, let me remind everyone that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Take a moment and subscribe to SubChina Access and start getting the daily newsletter delivered right to your inbox. Members get an early version of this podcast, usually on Monday evenings, East Coast time, instead of Thursday evenings, like the rest of you. They get discounts to our conferences, free admission to our live shows, and we're doing those every month in New York. And, of course, a berth aboard our Slack channel where you can talk directly. You can disintermediate everyone else and talk directly to our leading small group consisting of Jeremy Goldcorn and me. And you can also you know, take part in the live chats that we have. And Judy, you're officially invited to do one of our live chats with our guests. Those are a lot of fun. So everyone, sign up, show your support for what we're doing. On to recommendations, Jude. What do you have for us, man?
So in the vein of sort of marginalized communities and understanding what motivates, drives, and brings them together, we recently watched a really interesting documentary. We watched it on Netflix, but I'm sure it's available in other fine online platforms. But it's called Behind the Curve, and it's an investigation of flat earthers.
Oh, wow.
So it's directed by Daniel Clark, came out in 2018. Really well shot, really great group of really sympathetic characters, just really, really interesting people who believe a wacky set of ideas and have a really, really wacky worldview. But I just thought in this sort of age of polarization, any attempt to be empathetic, even if you can if you can absolutely disagree and find mortifying, that's fine. But I think some level of empathy to understand what's driving these people to move away from sort of rational scientific conclusions about the world is a worthwhile endeavor. So this is really well done. Includes a few songs by a band I like called Real Estate in the soundtrack. So that's another reason to like it. But highly recommended for people who are interested in marginalized communities and groups.
Well, I certainly am. I'm going to watch that today, man. I mean, all my shows are done. So, I mean, I got to watch something. I think I got one more episode of Chernobyl, and then have you been watching that?
No.
Oh my God,
it's great.
Oh, it's just fantastic.
We're canceling our HBO Go. I should.
I know. Take the time to watch Chernobyl before you cancel, because it's definitely worth watching. And by the way, listen to the Peter Sagal podcast that he does with the producer of Chernobyl. It's really terrific. It's just called the Chernobyl podcast, but that's not my recommendation. My recommendation is actually a book called How to Hide an Empire by Daniel Immerwahr. He's a professor at Northwestern. It's about the United States beyond the logo map of the familiar logo map of the lower 48. You know, that's sort of what we think of you know, the contiguous lower states. But about how it went on, how the United States, you know, actually went about acquiring and then kind of entering this phase of denial about its empire abroad, not just the American imperium of, you know, Hollywood movies and, you know, its soft power empire, or even like its network of military bases, but actually, you know, territories that were held. I'm talking about obviously Puerto Rico. He talks actually quite a bit about pre-state Alaska and Hawaii, you know, in relations with the indigenous peoples there, but also quite a bit about all the filibusters and the efforts to go after Cuba. And the war in the Philippines, which is just, you've read about it in, you know, what's his name,
Howard Zinn.
Howard Zinn, right. But this is just at a level of granularity that I haven't seen before. This guy writes just wonderfully. It's a terrifically readable book. I mean, I highly recommend it. If I were teaching an American history course, I would absolutely assign it to undergrads. It's just a fascinating book. It goes off on some just marvelous tangents, especially when he tries to explain sort of the technologies that enabled America to sort of forego empire. The guy teaches history of science, and so there's a lot of stuff in that as well. I mean, that he sort of shows his chops. It's delicious. It's really fun. Jude, man, thank you so much for taking the time, and I'm so glad you could come down here, man. Happy birthday to your great aunt.
Thank you very much.
She remembers who you are, finally.
Yep. That's took good. 5 minutes, but she got there.
Let's go get some barbecue.
Sounds good.
All right. The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo, me, and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Sessions of Business Brief, the Pandaily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, new voices, talk, and the Middle Earth Podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.